is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Renewables cannot power the world we know. Dr. Simon Michaud from the Geological Survey of Finland crunched the numbers. There is not enough time and not enough metals. In this unique interview on Rachel Donald's Planet Critical broadcast, Michaud explains the limits and what we can do in a sustainable society.
Go to planetcritical.com to learn more and subscribe.
Hello and welcome to Planet Critical, the podcast for a world in crisis. Every week I interview experts who are battling to save our planet. My guests are scientists, politicians, academics, journalists, and activists, revealing what's really going on and what they think needs to be done. This is a critical time for our planet. It demands critical thinking. My guest this week is Simon Michaud. Simon is an associate professor at the Geological Survey of Finland, and for years he's been researching the minerals crisis. The fact that we just don't have enough minerals and materials in the Earth's crust to develop a fully renewable economy. Simon's work shows that if we want a livable future, we're going to have to reduce our energy demands, our material demands, and live smaller, simpler lives. He joins me to give me an update on his work in the year and a half since we've spoken. He explains the mineral shortage, for those of you who haven't heard the first episode. He then discusses the mining problem, looking at the fiscal structures that will make a renewable economy very difficult. He walks us through how renewables are underperforming and discusses the battery problem. He then explains how to engineer a society that is livable and sustainable for the future, introducing us to a concept he's been working on called the resource-balanced economy. I hope you all enjoy the episode. If you do, please share it far and wide. I wonder, Simon, could you give a two-minute summary for anybody that doesn't yet understand what the problem is with our minerals and our materials?
Right. Okay. All right. So my name is Simon Michaud. I'm an associate professor of the Geological Survey of Finland. The last couple of years, I have been tracking information and data in the industrial system to understand not only fossil fuels, like what does fossil fuels do for us now, but our ability to transfer and phase out those fossil fuels by applying the plan that we call the green transition. And what I have found is this problem is actually much, much larger than first understood, and that a lot of the very basics have not been done by our policy leaders. They have just been talking in vague platitudes without actually doing the actual math of the practicalities of what they're proposing. One of the outcomes I have found is that the ability for us to actually deliver the number of electric vehicles, their batteries, solar panels, wind turbines, has serious mineral shortfalls, not only in production now, but also our industrial manufacturing capacity that is available in China, that's also too small, and our reserves and our resources and the resources under the sea, all not enough. So we've got a fundamental problem, and the way out of it is just to make a different plan. But that very, very basic solution seems to be too much for a lot of our policymakers at the moment. And so there's a lot of hand-wringing going on.
So what you're saying is that we have a fossil-fueled economy right now. And as listeners of the show will know, fossil fuel is very energy-dense, incredible fuel. We sort of waste a lot of it because it's just so abundant. And we cannot substitute that fossil fuel economy with a renewable economy because we're lacking the minerals and the materials to do so.
Yes. And but even if we had those materials, we actually don't have the time to bring it online. Mm-hmm. And now we've also got the problems. We don't have the money either.
Boom.
So they've really made sure to make the worst possible mess this possible.
Mm.
Some very, very unfortunate problem solving has been used, where everyone is assuming someone else is somewhere has actually already done this and everything's fine.
Yeah.
Everyone's referencing everyone else in a hall of mirrors with the understanding that they've not actually looked at actually going and phasing out fossil fuels because it's so easy to keep using it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like an environmentalist saying, we don't want mining, but then goes down to the shop and buys a computer.
Yeah.
Right, that has actually been manufactured on the other side of the planet using mining methods that you would think that are not only unethical, but they're actually, we would consider them illegal.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the situation we have found ourselves in. And it is remarkable. It's like we've got a series of blind spots as a culture. And there's more than one. And one of those blind spots is we tend to believe our own bullshit.
Yeah.
And that is at all levels, but it's especially at the policymaking level.
Well, what is the alternative? I mean, if we live in like a growth-obsessed system and success and development is measured by growth, then to start talking about degrowth is sort of antithetical to the whole project.
Well, the basic problem is the last 50 years, we've used ideology to solve all our problems.
Yeah.
Right. Our currency, for example, is now what's called fiat. It's virtual. If we want to balance our budget, we just print more money. It's been this way since the early 1970s. Right. And for that reason, we have become untethered from reality, and as the virtual financial world is where we believe reality is.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, back at the Batcave, reality is now starting to impose itself. So here
we are.
That's
a good way of putting it. The virtual financial world is where we think reality is.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, certainly we see it given, I mean, you'll be able to speak more on this than I can, but, you know, the obsession with net zero policies is if emissions that go out into the sky, if they're balanced on some digital book in some way, then it's as if they don't actually exist in the atmosphere, as if the biosphere is digital in some way as well and can be deleted like a series of zeros and ones.
So this all comes down to a fundamental misunderstanding of the commodities industry.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We believe like the last, I don't know, 100 years, our technology has developed in like a 2 to 4 year cycle where a need will arise and then someone will go out and they'll invent a technology and that'll change the world. And the point from having the idea to actually getting it to market in the private sector seems to be around 2 to 4 years. Not always, but the commodities sector takes 20 years to open a single mine.
Right.
So it happens much slower. And the innovation in the commodity sector does tend to happen in very small increments. Oil and gas is different because a lot of money goes into it. But in the mining industry, the actual science behind mining hasn't changed much since the 20s.
Yeah.
Right. And so the engineering has changed as we've sort of gone along. But the basic principle behind flotation, crushing, grinding, the last innovation was someone invented the hydrocyclone in 1920. And we've also got the problem where we've gone for the highest grade deposits first and you end up with the lowest grade deposits later. And we're using the same basic formula for the industry to actually operate. And that has happened all the way along.
Mm-hmm. When you say a first grade deposit and a low grade deposit, does that mean sort of the quality of minerals that are being mined?
Yeah. So not only is it the grade, so for every, like, say, ton of ore, how much metal do you have in it? And so when I started my career in, say, the mid 90s, the cutoff grade for copper was about 2 or 3%. And below that, we didn't bother. It wasn't economic. Now the cutoff grade, or cutoff grades for feasibility studies that I've actually taken part of, is
0.1%. Hang on, 0.1% of a mineral within in a deposit of ore?
Yeah, yeah.
That's so a crazy amount of destruction for very little material.
Let's say you had like a gold ring on your finger, right? That gold ring has 3 tons of waste somewhere on a mining dump somewhere.
Oh, my God.
Right, so this is the thing. So we've gone from, say, 2 or 3% to 0.1% in the space of my career. You know, one person, which is 28 years, 25 years, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other problem is the minerals themselves that we need to liberate it from the rock. So with the little particles, metal, we want them to be separate so we can actually then pull them out. But if the little grains of minerals are really small, right, the smaller you go, the more energy you've got to import in grinding, and it goes up exponentially. It's not a linear relationship, it's exponential. So to grind from, say, when my career started, the closing size for your conventional copper plant was around 150 micron.
What does that mean?
So you've got to take the rock, then we're going to crush it and then grind it. So most of what you've crushed and grind is smaller than 150 microns in size.
Okay.
Right. And so imagine you have like a giant big pile of particles, and then we're going to put it through what's called a flotation plant, which actually uses a chemical or physical difference to pull out the metals. And so what we're doing is copper, for example, is what's called hydrophobic. It does not like water. Mm-hmm. So you put it into water and then you put bubbles in it. You know, lots of bubbles, like say, in your washing up. And as the bubbles rise through that, a copper particle will go, oh, there's a pocket of air, and it'll want to stick to that pocket of air more than it wants to stay in the water. And so that rises to the top, and you have what's called a froth bed.
Mm-hmm.
Scrape the froth bed off, and you've concentrated it to about 25% copper.
Wow.
So
but then
you've got to take that and then put that in a smelter, which will then refine it down and then to the point where you get 99.999% pure copper in a refining circuit on the other side. So that's what they're doing. But if you've got to grind down to 150 micron, right, that's X amount of power. But if you've now got to grind down to 10 micron, that's not a linear relationship. You've got this exponential curve called the Hooke energy relationship. So vastly more energy is required to go finer. And what we're now tackling is deposits that are very disseminated and small grained. So we're going to need much, much more energy and much, much more potable water consumed to actually extract a unit of metal compared to, say, 30 years ago.
Right. So the problem is there aren't enough reserves to make the transition. The reserves that we do have are of a lower quality.
Yep.
The energy cost to get the materials out of those reserves that we would need and to refine them would also be higher.
Yep.
And all in the time when we are running out of the fuel that we currently use to run our economy, that we would need to also build everything for the renewable transition. So it seems like
There's another problem again. Our mining system at the moment is heavily dependent on fossil fuels.
Yeah.
So what we do is we send like a gas pipeline out to the middle of nowhere to a power plant that generates a lot of electricity, and that electricity runs some of the machines. And you have a diesel truck and shovel fleet to actually bring in the ore from the open pit, right? And so we're not mining with solar panels and wind turbines. Right, and when we do, it's going to get real.
What does that mean?
A mine is actually based around an economic feasibility.
Mm-hmm.
Is it economically viable to do? It's a very, very well-organized economic business model based on what's there, right? And at the moment, the cutoff grade associated with what is economically viable is associated with the mining costs. And power is a big cost.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if that power triples or is now 10 times what it was before for one reason or another, then what is previously economic is no longer economic. So costs are going to go up.
What about the fact that renewable energy is getting progressively cheaper? Going to get cheaper than fossil fuels, and then
so hang on, it's getting cheaper when it's still a small system.
Mm-hmm.
But if it can be shown that we don't have enough minerals in the ground to make a replacement system, we will hit a asymptote in the market where all of a sudden there's now scarcity of metal supply, and the systems you want to use are no longer available on the market. So that cheap price cannot stay cheap. It's a temporary situation. It's a situation while we have metal to supply, things are fine, right? But when we actually want to ramp up and actually sort of start doing this for real, then we've got a problem. So when I say it's going to get real is when the mining industry now has to run in a situation where it is on non-fossil fuel systems only, right? The manufacturing supply chain at the moment is only conceptual, and we just haven't thought it through. Like, fossil fuels are a hidden subsidy for everything. Take that away, you've now got a hidden penalty. And I think a lot of mining and a lot of manufacture will just simply stop.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Right, and that's just,
mm-hmm.
you know, what do you do?
Mm. And then I imagine it becomes a bit of a sort of descending spiral then as well, in that you've got mining that stops. And also, I think it's worth putting out at this point that for all the advocate of a transition, like, there's lots of environmental discussions and problems around mining and the excesses of mining and the fact that we do not prioritize our resource use. For example, you know, digging out gold, producing 3 tons of waste so that it can go on somebody's finger. But if we're in a position where we don't have fossil fuels to do the work and then mining progressively shuts down, then you can sort of kiss goodbye to any dream of an increasingly expansive renewable economy.
Yeah. So what ends up happening is it moves out of an economic free market paradigm into a strategic asset paradigm, because fossil fuels are going, and the only plan B we have is at the moment wind turbines, solar panels and EVs. We don't have a technology somewhere else, and we can't wait anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. So the green transition will happen. What I'm saying is it will be much, much smaller than we think. And so we're entering into a world of a energy contraction, like a sharp energy contraction. And we're just not prepared for it at the moment. And there's going to be a reordering and a revaluing of society. When we mine, for example, we use what's called the net present value tool, which works out that the basic principle is if you've got, like, say, a £1 note in your hand, that's worth more than if you maybe get, say, £2 or £3 in a year's time, because you might not. It actually has a discount rate for risk, right? And so when you invest in something, you actually have a risk assessment on whether it's a worthwhile investment or not. And so the more metal you've got in the ground that's actually accessible, the more value that's involved. But if it takes such a long time to develop, because that NPV calculation is insensitive after about 7 or 8 years.
What does that mean, insensitive?
Whatever happens after 7 or 8 years is of such a little impact, it's not really included in the calculation.
Okay.
So what that means is any rehabilitation costs of closing the mine down are actually not included in the startup cost in that calculation.
Oh.
Right. And so they've got to include it in things like as to get a mining license. Right. But the economic viability is not linked directly to that, because the NPV tool doesn't really allow it.
Okay.
Because it's all about money and they're all about starting. Like in the South America, masses and masses and masses of mining going on. You've got all these huge tailing dams and no one knows what to do with them.
Mm.
Yeah, there's huge, huge expanses of mining waste.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all fine while it's a relatively small problem. But when the problems start to telescope out and get large, the tires that come off the dump trucks in one of the mines, I think it's Escondida, or it's one of the ones in South America, that tire stockpile of worn-out tires is so large it can be seen from space.
Really?
Apparently. you can see it on Google Earth. And I think, well, gosh, guys. And so, yeah. So if you're mining in a mine that's been operating for, say, 30, 40 years, and it's processing 3,000 or 4,000 tons an hour, and you're only taking 0.5% of the mass and the rest gets dumped somewhere.
Yeah,
now what?
Where does it go? Yeah. Okay. So when we last spoke, and I want to get on to what you think a viable renewable economy will look like and what that actually means. But when we last spoke, the idea was trying to get more of this information in front of policymakers and try and get them to listen. You've had success. Can you talk us through that? You spoke to the UN.
Yeah, it's a little strange for me still. Until a couple of years ago, I was just used to being ignored like everyone else. And this was considered normal. I've presented my work now since the release of the first report, say, which was August 2021 or July 2021, something like that. And so it's been we're approaching 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
In that time, I have presented my work over 160 times. But it's been often to groups that are like ministers of government, civil servants who are actually sort of advising ministers, universities, policy groups, investment groups. I've presented to the UN a couple of times, I think like 3 or 4 times now. And in each circumstance, they're saying the same things. First thing they always say is they were in shock. They were not prepared for what I had showed them.
Mm-hmm.
They often say things like, this is like drinking from a fire hose. Because every time someone criticizes my work, I go away and think about it. And then I add something into the next presentation to answer that criticism. Mm-hmm. And that's how you end up with such an information-rich 30 minutes talk. And so the second thing is no one has been able to refute my work. They don't criticize me to my face. The monkeys on Twitter like throwing poo, but the people who actually work to my face can't refute it because I'm using their own data. There is one gray area of discussion which is something we should talk about, and that is the size of the buffer stationary storage power units for wind and solar.
Oh, and the stationary storage power unit, does that mean battery?
Yeah. I'm using batteries, but there are other things you can use, like pumped hydro storage and stuff. There are bottlenecks, every single one of those. We should discuss that in a moment, while that is. The third thing they say is, all right, you scared the hell out of us, now you're going to fix it. I don't care how you do it, but you fix it and you fix it now. And so they want a solution for plan B, and that's now in progress. So the people who are actually looking at this, they're not refuting it, and they often ask me to come back. Mm-hmm. Like the Climate Change Fund in Finland, a group called Citra, they looked at this stuff, and they said, right. And Finland's a culture where it is based on, you know, let's look at the facts. And if the facts are uncomfortable, we've got to look at this. And that's more prominent here in Finland than anywhere else, whereas in Australia you've got the headless chicken approach to things that challenge their paradigm. Just don't worry about it, leave us alone. So the Finns and the Swedes are all looking at this. The Department of Energy in America has picked up on this work.
Yes.
And they are actually auditing it internally, and they're trying to sort out whether I'm right or not. And they did their own study, and they found that conceptually the problems, especially with wind and solar, were correct. They're underperforming.
Could you give us more details about how they're underperforming? Rather than just, okay, so beyond the, because I assume this is beyond the fact that we don't have the minerals to run our
This is something else. This is something else. Right. So wind, let's do solar first. So solar is highly intermittent. It's very vulnerable to the weather and it only works during the day. Mm-hmm. So according to the Energy Observatory Agency, which I collect the stats on, or what power was produced, not what they thought they did or what they promised, what did they actually report? And solar globally, well, on average, was producing 11.4% of the calendar year. That's the operating hours that they delivered power. So that's like for a 365-day year, they were producing power for 30 days or 40 days, whatever it is. Most of the time, they are idle for these assets. Whereas a coal-fired power station is available something like 92% of the time. Mm-hmm. So when you're replacing a coal-fired power station, you're putting it with many, 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 many solar units and wind units because they're idle most of the time because they're vulnerable to the weather. There's not a damn thing we can do about it. Because then the thing, you've got to transport the power out.
Yeah.
And so if you had, for example, solar power in the desert, it would be better because you've got better solar radiance. But then you've got to transport the power to where it's needed. Mm-hmm. And the closer you get to the poles, like North Pole, South Pole, the more extreme the difference between winter and summer is. Now, the Princeton University in America developed the Net Zero America project. And so one of the things they looked at was how much buffer do they need? And so they looked at the day-to-day differences between supply and demand must balance to a millionth of a second.
Oh, wow.
Right. So, and it must be clean sinusoidal power without spikes. It must be the frequency of like 50 hertz, and it must be the same voltage, same current. And if it deviates even a little bit, it'll cook your computer. Mm-hmm. You know, like things like a blackout or a brownout, that'll cook your computer. So this is the difference between the day-to-day power generation. And so they thought they only needed 5 to 7 hours of power storage buffer.
Per day?
No, for the whole grid to operate continually across the year.
Okay.
Right, so it's a very small amount. What they did not consider is the differences of the seasons. Like the sun in winter is much, much less strong than the sun in summer. Mm-hmm. Solar radiance, solar hours. They didn't consider that. Right, and so if solar now represents, according to the IEA, 38% of the global energy mix.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and yes, I think it's like 72 for wind and solar together. Right. So now it's most of the energy is now solar and wind.
God.
Right. So that's what they're proposing, right? So these systems are now so large, they've got to be internally self-sufficient. You can't balance them off against something else, right? And so that system has to ride through winter when we want to spend power to heat buildings, right? That also happens to be when we have the poorest sun radiance.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened now is most power generation is fossil fuel in some form. Coal or gas, it's like 60% or something, and some oil. That can be done in any weather conditions, any time of year, in any location. And so each power grid, what they do is no one produces exactly the amount of power they need. Some systems use too much, some too little, and then they trade it.
Mm-hmm.
They balance everything up by trading. Usually the gas industry, which is very flexible, can go, it can be turned up and down at will. And so the gas industry is the buffer glue that holds everything together. Take gas away, we can't balance the system. Right. So if we are going to take fossil fuels away, but now we've got these systems that are highly vulnerable to the weather, they're now the main energy systems. We have never had to actually balance internally a large renewable system.
Mm-hmm.
The wind turbines in Denmark, for example, are balanced with power that are fossil fuel based coming from Germany and Sweden.
Yeah.
And so that's how they do it. Right. But if you've got the system.
That means when they drop out, the fossil fuel power will kick in, will step in.
Yes. Right. Yes. That's right. Yeah. And so, and when they generate more, the fossil fuels can reduce a bit. And so they're able to do this through the trading of fossil fuels. But a renewable power grid won't be able to do that. So what it means, though, is. If we can't work out a way around this, then we are not going to wind and solar are actually not viable in their current form.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But the solution is not to flog ourselves to go off and find more buffer.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. With your host, Alex Smith.
We return to the hard facts about sustainable energy with Rachel Donald of Planet Critical and Dr. Simon Michaud, a mining engineer with the Geological Survey of Finland. The conversation returns with battery storage solutions, followed by Michaud's visions of true sustainable life.
So why batteries? Okay, pumped hydro storage is the cheapest way to do it at the moment.
And pumped hydro storage? Is that when you pump water up to the top of a hill and then it's got potential energy and then you release it and it's kinetic energy?
So you need to actually have a place where you can actually do that. A place that actually is capable of having a hydro plant, and then you've got an elevated part where you can actually pump it up and it can come back down again.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is we need about 2,000 terawatt hours of capacity to be stored. This is the capacity they need to ride through winter. This is for the 28 days. 28 days equals 2,100 terawatt hours. Now, that's huge. Most hydro systems that are actually okay for hydro already have a hydro plant on them. There's not very many left that don't have a hydro plant on them. Right. So now you've got to find hydro plants with a place with a raised area, so the raised reservoir, and they're even rarer.
Mm-hmm.
Now find 2,000 terawatt hours capacity for that.
What does 2,000 terawatt hours mean for us non-scientific people? How much power is that?
Okay, so in the year 2018, we used 26,614 terawatt hours.
Wow, so 10% of our global energy use almost.
Yes, as it stands now. You can probably expand pumped hydro a bit, but nowhere near enough to meet that requirement. Then you've got things like compressed air storage in caverns. Now, that has engineering scaling issues. You can't just put it anywhere. And you need to have like a geological, you know, geomechanical competency underground. And so you can do it for a bit. But again, 2,000 terawatt hour capacity. And the other one is spinning flywheels.
What are they?
You spin a flywheel up and it spins and spins and spins and it keeps spinning. And then later, then you use it to generate electricity because you keep spinning. It works, right? Yeah. Has its application, but you've got your efficiency curves there.
Okay.
And again, you've got some engineering footprint problems. So and the other one's supercapacitors, where there's like a battery, but you put